Thank you, guys. It's a real pleasure to be coming and speaking here. I've been going to Waxaw Bible for about 5 months or so, and my wife would tell you that I wouldn't say this if I didn't really think it, but there's a lot of quality people here that I have a lot of respect for, and I'm really growing and increasing in my respect for the quality of people that are here, just the love that you guys have shown to us, the things that I've heard you guys have worked through. It's just a very impressive body of believers. So I say that also because when I speak, a lot of times I say sometimes things that are somewhat provocative, but I do it for a reason. It's because I try to get people to think about what they believe and think about the fundamental reasons for why they believe those things. And I think for me, when I went to Iowa State, what really impressed why they believed what they believed that I gave. I had these wonderful experiences. I grew up in a church and I have these really fuzzy feelings when I listen to 91.9. And therefore, God exists. And not just God exists, but the Christian God exists. And not just that the Christian God exists, but the Bible is true. And it's the book that tells us about God. So this morning, what I want to try to do is help you understand how an atheist views you, what they think about you, and then maybe offer some ways of approaching atheists and agnostics that might be a little bit more beneficial than the ways that we've approached them in the past. So to begin, though, how many of you believe in God? Okay. How many of you believe that there's only one God and not lots of gods? Okay. How about how many of you believe that the true God is the God spoken of in the Bible? Okay, so we have a pretty homogeneous group here. You all agree with that. So, as an atheist, since you guys don't have very good reasons for believing in a God, and the Bible is riddled with contradictions, and there's other religions that believe things like there's many gods and not just one God, or there's even other religions that believe in one God, but you believe in one religion that believes in one particular God. So to argue for all of that stuff, you usually give reasons like, well, it made me feel good, or God made my life a whole lot better than it used to be when I was into alcohol and drugs and that kind of thing, right? Those are the kinds of arguments that we give. And when you say those kinds of things to an atheist, here's what they're thinking. They're thinking that you're stupid. They're thinking that you don't know what you're talking about. They're thinking that you're deluded. And they interpret your gathering together in a church like this, seeing all the people who all agree with each other, to help reinforce this psychological delusion that you have. And in fact, you should see this because you keep telling people that if you leave the church and if you don't show up to church on Sundays regularly, then you'll probably fall away from the faith. Well, why would that be if you had good reasons to believe what you believe? To me, speaking as a hypothetical atheist, this smacks of a kind of psychological self-reinforcing delusion. And why would it be otherwise? How can you expect me to believe that there's a God from flimsy things like God touched my life, or there are too many coincidences in life for there to not be a God, or I was listening, I already used the listening to 91.9, had a God moment. But what makes you think those are good reasons for believing in a God? You've never seen him? Is there anybody here who's seen God walking around? Ask him, hey God, do you exist? And then even if you did see some big being in the sky, how would you know it's not just a hallucination? How would you know that? How do you know that you're not just hearing voices? How do you know that? So all of these kind of fall under this idea that atheists have, that you just don't have any evidence to believe in God. There just isn't any good evidence to believe that. But what's worse is atheists will give further arguments that, okay, let's just, for the sake of argument, say that the belief that you have in God is true. We'll just adopt the idea of a Christian God and say, okay, that's true. Let's flesh that out and see if that actually works. You can believe that God's all-powerful, right? He's all-knowing. He's all-loving. And when we think about the idea that God's all-powerful, it means that he can do anything. Not just anything we can do, but just anything, right? Well, there's something that seems to be, for the atheist, inconsistent with just that very notion. If God can do anything, and even and in your own scriptures it says that God cannot sin. So if you believe that God can do anything, but then also believe that God can't sin, it seems like there's some kind of contradiction involved in affirming both of those. Okay, so is he all-powerful? Well, then why can't he sin? Even I can sin, and I'm not all-powerful, right? So if he can sin, it doesn't seem like he's all good, though. So if God can sin, then another claim that we make, namely that God is all good, seems to be false. However, if we say that he can't sin, it seems like he's not all-powerful. So right now, we have the horns of a dilemma here. Just look, given your view of God, the idea itself seems incoherent. It doesn't even make sense to get off the ground to be a rational view. So given these things, rather than trying to give a rational explanation for your belief in God, atheists and agnostics often give a psychological account for why you believe in God, which is what I alluded to earlier. You say, look, why do you believe in God? I can't explain it rationally because there's no good rational reason to believe in God, right? So you must believe for some psychological reason. Maybe it's this ubiquitous fear of death. Everyone has some grasp at some point in their life grasps the fact that they're going to die. And every person has to psychologically deal with that fact. And how do we deal with that fact as a human race typically? We posit gods. We posit an afterlife because it makes us feel better, right? This is a psychological explanation for why we might believe in God. And then again, why do we gather in corporate environments like this? To reinforce that, because we have this deep-seated psychological need to believe in God. Given this mindset, it shouldn't be surprising to you that when you go and give an atheist your personal testimony, you're actually reinforcing their belief in atheism, because you're giving what they consider to be insanely weak arguments for the existence of God. They're not even interested. You're not even engaging in the conversation as far as they're concerned when you give your personal testimony. Now, I'm not saying that there's no value in that, that there's no place for your personal testimony in evangelism. Obviously, it is. But there's a growing movement in America and around the world of atheism, spearheaded by people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and then TV shows like Cosmos, where there's a growing number of people who are hostile to the Christian faith and think that as Christians we're stupid, right? Now, our initial reaction is, look, there's software engineers in here, there's linguists in here, there's Christian professors of philosophy, obviously Christians aren't just dumb, right? We would think that. And they say, yeah, look, I know that Christians can do those kinds of things. They can do things that smart people do. But when it comes to their belief in God, they're stupid, right? So you can talk to them all day about those kinds of things, engineering and the kinds of things you do for your profession. But as soon as you start talking about God, all of a sudden you become a mystic, a crazy person. How do we get around that? Or even should we get around that? Should we try to respond to that? Or should we just say, look, we're fools for Christ and that's it? That's all there is. You can do that, and there may even be instances where that's helpful. Maybe people will find that rhetorically interesting or persuasive. But by and large, that kind of line, especially with atheists and agnostics, it helps to reinforce their idea that we don't know what we're talking about. And we don't need to do that. The problem is that the church largely today is ignorant of things that the Christian church has done over the last 2,000 years. Apologetics isn't new. Giving reasons for the hope that we have, giving reasons or evidences for the existence of God is not something new. It's something that the church has been doing for a very long time, but usually we just don't know what those arguments are. So I want to give you some of those arguments so that we have something else other than our personal experience. Something that's a little more objective that we can refer to when saying, look, it's not just a psychological delusion. If my arguments for the existence of God are bad, you can give some kind of psychological account for why I believe these things. But I maintain that my arguments for the existence of God are not bad. So you don't need to give a psychological explanation for why I believe these things. It's not just fear of death. It's not just that we sit around and try and reinforce this psychological you know, this delusion. We actually have arguments for it. Peter Kraft, in his book, outlines about 20 arguments, and they're not all necessarily that great. Some are stronger than others. But there are actually a lot of arguments, and what we'll do is we'll go over some of the more popular ones. But before we do, I also want to emphasize that part of the reason that what we give arguments is, to me, I think, is that it's part of glorifying God. When we glorify God, we are making him look appealing to other people. Saying, here, God is beautiful, God is good, God is this or that. When we're talking to atheists, we glorify God by saying, it is reasonable to believe in God. Because by and large, atheists and agnostics value reason above all other things. Not, I think, deep down, but I think superficially. They value reason above anything else. And if you're not reasonable, you are not to be associated with, you're not to be taken seriously. So I think part of our giving these kinds of arguments to atheists is a way of glorifying God and honoring him by saying that, look, as Christians, we can offer you reasoned responses to your criticisms of our belief in God. And in that way, show that Christianity actually encompasses every aspect of your life, not just your emotional life, not just meeting your physical needs, not just helping you to will to help your neighbor and that kinds of things. It does those things, but it also is the most intellectually satisfying view out there. That's how I think we need to help glorify God increasingly in this culture. Unfortunately, since we haven't realized that we need to maybe change our tactics or change our approach with atheists and agnostics, there's a growing number of them, and it's starting to make its way into the political arena. Imagine a world where you get fired for being intolerant because you disagree with some particular political stance. And you do it so on religious grounds, and since religion is an irrational set of beliefs, why should I listen to you in the political sphere? Imagine a world where you're legally obligated to go to therapy if you believe in God. When I was doing my undergraduate at Iowa State, we talked about, in our psychology classes, we talked about something called normalcy, because when we talk about psychological problems, you measure a person's psychological problems based off of what you think is normal and rational and reasonable. And they define deviation from normalcy by being unreasonable, irrational, or holding to irrational beliefs. It would not be that far of a jump for them to try to force Christians, because they believe it's an irrational set of beliefs, is when we start to become more and more the minority, to go to some kind of counseling or some kind of therapy in order to get rid of your irrational set of beliefs. Or imagine that if they said, look, if you're going to teach your children Christianity, you're going to be charged for child abuse because you're psychologically manipulating them and indoctrinating them. This is not just a hypothetical. Richard Dawkins is pushing for this law, these kinds of laws, over in the UK. It's not just and we shouldn't think that just because we're the church that we won't go through some kind of suffering or actually very bad suffering at the hands of people like this in the future. If we think that that's not possible, then we don't know church history. We don't know how badly people have been treated and what people have done to each other over lesser things than this. So I think publicly we need to start taking seriously the idea that when we engage atheists and agnostics, it's not that our personal testimony is not necessarily good, it's that it's very often unhelpful in a situation, especially talking with atheists and agnostics. So we talked a little bit, I think last week, Jeremy talked about the biblical basis for doing apologetics. Because we're going to ask the question, should we even do this? And I think I'm just going to point out one example from Acts 17 and look a little bit more carefully at that to show not that the Bible tells us you have to go out and give rational arguments for the existence of God, but that it's at least consistent with things that the apostles did. Right? So in Acts chapter 17, if you guys have your Bibles, if you could open it to that. And we will start in verse 16, chapter 17, verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" And others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus in the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus. I'm very bad at pronouncing things, I'm sorry. The Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and all foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing else except telling and hearing something new. It's kind of funny. In verse 22, here's where Paul addresses them. Keep in mind who he's addressing. He's at least addressing Stoic and Epicurean philosophers. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Man of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way around toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far away from each one of us." And he actually continues, he says, "For in him we live and move and have our being, even as some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." What's interesting about this is Paul is not giving an argument for the existence of God here. The existence of God is presupposed here. What Paul is doing is he's saying that what you believe about God is not true. Let me correct that. Okay? So I don't think this is a direct text justifying our argument for the existence of God. But I want to go through it just briefly to explain why I think it's relevant to giving an argument for the existence of God. So what Paul does here is it's clear that he's aware of what Stoics and Epicureans thought. But Paul basically goes through, they call him a proclaimer of foreign gods, and he says, look, God made the world and everything in it, and he's sovereign over all of it, not just some regional god. He's not just a regional god. He said, therefore, it's silly to think that God is made by men and lives in temples, as a response also to idols as well. I mean, he sees the idols and he's displeased and distressed by this. He says, also, it's silly to think that God needs anything from us. He's the one that gives life and breath to everything and everyone. And this God who sustains all has placed everyone where they are so they might know him. Stoicism held that breath is the sustaining cause of all existing bodies and gives them life and animates them. So when Paul says, the God who made the world and everything in it, who is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands, as if he needed anything, because he himself gives breath and life to everything and to everyone. He's siding with the Stoic philosophers against the Epicureans. The Epicureans, well, I'll get to that in a second. Secondly, the Stoics have sort of a biological conception of God. They almost believe that it's in what's called a type of pantheism almost, that God isn't above nature, but he's sort of in nature, working in it to achieve some ultimate plan or end and constantly creating it. And they also believe that God was he was an active sort of intelligence or seed of all things that grow. So I think not necessarily that Paul meant it this way, but the Stoics, when they heard him say something like, from one man he made every nation of the human race, it's something that's at least not that far off from what they believed. They also believe that God directs and develops the universe down to the smallest detail. And when Paul says, for one man, or again, that same verse, he says, from one man he made every nation of the human race to inhabit the entire earth, determining their set times and their fixed limits of places where they would live. Again, Paul is not deeply, because Paul would disagree with the Stoics on many points, right? He doesn't completely agree with them, but he's pointing out areas of agreement and then elaborating on them. Because while he says, look, God places limits on everybody and places them where they would live, but Paul adds to the Stoic philosophy by giving a reason why God sets times and fixed limits for where people would live, so that they would search for God and perhaps grope around and find him. This was not Stoic philosophy. They didn't necessarily have a reason or a loving God. Paul adds to that. Paul departs from them on some other matters in this text, and I won't go into that, but I wanted to point out that he's siding with them, at least ostensibly, to gain their audience, but then to add to their knowledge of who God is. Now, to the Epicureans, they believe that the gods, God or gods are physical, and that you can see them in temples or in the sky or whatever. So when he says that we should not think that the deities are like gold or silver or stone, an image made out of human skill or imagination, he's directly confronting the Epicureans. He's directly confronting them, too, because the Epicureans believed that these gods were not interested in the affairs of man. And Paul responds saying, no, God is interested in the affairs of man. He determines the times and places where people should live so that they might reach out and find him. And more than that, he desires, at the end of the time, he will judge you for what you have done. And he proved this by his resurrection. And we see here that the people were most offended by his reference to the resurrection. What I want to point out here is that Paul knows his audience. He knows what he's getting into. He's not going into this and just giving a standard set of evangelistic quips or anything like that. He's saying, look, I know the Stoics believe this. I know the Epicureans believe this. I'm going to go in here, and I'm going to be able to identify some with the Stoics so that I can get their attention, so that we can talk how clearly wrong the Epicureans are. And we find that some people listened to him and some people didn't. My guess is that the Stoics are probably more interested in listening to Paul. But the broader point I want to make is that I think that Paul here displays a remarkable amount of plasticity in his approach to evangelism. He says, look, I need to know what they're going to say so that I can tailor my comments to what they're thinking, and so that I know something about how they're going to react when I say this to them. This is something that typically we fall short on, and studying this kind of stuff is going to help us to understand our audience better. So, let me ask real quick, how much time do we have? Sorry? 11 o'clock? Okay, well, what I want to do is elaborate on that, because what he's doing here kind of departs from our evangelistic tendencies, is to just go and give the gospel message or give the five, or maybe the Romans wrote or something like that. Again, not bad. But again, in an increasingly atheistic world, you have to make sure that you understand how that's going to be taken. And that's why I began this talk by talking about, are you guys just psychologically deluding yourself? Because that's how they're going to take what you say when you do that. It actually takes them back when you start giving them reasons. So let's talk a little bit about what some of those reasons for our belief in God are, at least some of the classical arguments. What we're doing is we're not giving a kind of mathematical proof when we argue for the existence of God. Okay? We're not giving any kind of lab experiment. We can't put God in a test tube and say, see, there's a God. Right? That's not how we argue for God's existence. What we usually do is we argue from effects to a cause. Right? In Romans 1, we see that for his invisible attributes, speaking of God, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So what we're doing is we're arguing from the things that have been made to a maker. Okay? How you do that is important. You should do it in a way that's logically consistent. Sometimes there are some arguments that try to give rational arguments that attempt to demonstrate what are called transcendental preconditions for knowledge and that kind of stuff, and say God must be a transcendental precondition. I'm not going to get into that this morning, but I just want you to be aware that there's that kind of argument. There's also arguments that make what's called an inference to the best explanation. Say, look, there's several sets of different types of explanations for this thing that we know, and God seems to be the best explanation. But the kind of arguments that I want to give today are from effect to cause. And what I want you to do too, and I should have brought this up earlier, is that a big criticism of our arguments for the existence of God by atheists is what they call the God of the Gaps theory, arguments. They think that when they have a sort of narrative in their, or a story in their mind that goes something like this, they think, look, primitive man used to try to explain everything in terms of gods and invisible fairies and spirits in the trees and that kind of stuff. And as science came along and unveiled, look, you don't need a fairy to explain how trees grow. You don't need a god to explain how physics works or how biology works. We have evolution to do that. We have this to do that, right? You don't need these mythological or these invisible explanations. So when we give arguments sometimes, they misunderstand and think that what we're doing is we're just saying, oh, you can't explain that, therefore God must have done it. Oh, you can't explain that, therefore God must have done it. Okay, this is what's called sort of a God of the Gaps approach. And that is fallacious. They're right. If we do that, we're actually arguing in a fallacious manner. Fallacious being fallacy. We're using fallacious reasoning. So there's, historically, there's been major arguments like what are called the first cause argument. And this argument, this is a class of arguments. There's a whole bunch of different types of first cause arguments. Some of them argue that we can't go back to an infinity past. Therefore, there must have been a beginning of the universe and a cause of that beginning of the universe. Other first cause type arguments will say, look, everything that we see here and now is contingent. You don't have to exist. Then you require some kind of explanation for your existence, not just in the past, but right this second. It's possible that you don't exist. Therefore, there needs to be an explanation now for that. Again, this is not the tight, rigorous philosophical argument. I'm just giving you an overview of what the arguments are. Another argument is from design. We look at the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe and say, look, that the options for what can explain that are limited, and we think God is the best explanation for that. Another argument is the moral argument. This one argues basically from the existence of objective moral values to the existence of a moral lawgiver. Another argument, which I think Mike, who gave a talk about faith and reason, he likes this argument. It's called argument from the idea of God. And it's basically, look, we have an idea or a concept of the greatest conceivable being. And that greatest conceivable being must exist not only in thought, but in reality. This is like an old version of it by a guy named Anselm, but more contemporary versions of that argument have been given. It's not quite as recognized as being a good argument, but there are people, very, very smart people, who think it's a good argument. There's arguments, for example, from the necessity of God, from the existence of other minds. There's arguments from desire, all of these things. And you guys can go through and read this. I hope, you know, just a parenthetical statement about this, but also about all of these talks, is that if you've never discussed this material, if you've never read any of the material about arguments for the existence of God or for the resurrection or the New Testament reliability, that kind of stuff, don't think that this series of sermons is enough. Like, this is just basically kind of giving you guys an introduction to these things. Really, if you want to study these things in depth, it takes years of thinking through these things and studying other disciplines, theology, philosophy, languages, that kind of stuff, to really grapple with the problems. Because the argument that I'm going to give you here, there are substantive objections to the argument that I'm going to give you. But that doesn't mean it's a bad argument. It just means that you need to know what those objections are and also be able to respond to those. And it just takes a while to learn those kinds of things. Also, you may think that one argument is better than another, and another person might think another argument is better than another, but you need to have reasons for why you think that. So, moving on, I'm going to give you what's called the Kalam cosmological argument. And a cosmological argument is that class of arguments that I talked about that says there must have been a first cause. Okay, it's a first cause type of argument. And it goes like this. It's presented by a guy named William Lane Craig in what's called a syllogism. A syllogism, all it is in logic, is just a type of argument with two premises and a conclusion. And the two premises here are, whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. The second premise is, the universe began to exist. And the conclusion is, therefore, the universe has a cause of its existence. Okay, so I'll go over that again. It's, whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause of its existence. So that's the outline of the argument. What we have to do now in order to argue for that, or to defend that argument, is to show that the premises are true. Because the logical form of the argument is it's not in question. You know, even atheists, when they look at this argument, don't say that the form of the argument is bad. They say, look, the premises aren't necessarily true. So the premise one, whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence. Why would we think that? We think that because it's just another way of stating that nothing can't bring about something. It's what's called a metaphysical intuition. And now I have a particular view about language and using big words and stuff like that. I mean, people may not agree with that, but I think you should know what these words are so you have these categories to think in. It's what's a metaphysical intuition. Doesn't have to do with New Age and all that kind of stuff. Metaphysics kind of, a lot of people think of, oh, it has to do with pantheism and New Age stuff. It's not. Historically, it just has to deal with trying to understand the nature of things. Not just, like, not spirits and gods, but like mind-body stuff. Like, am I just a material being, or do I have a soul as well? Or is my soul immaterial, or is it kind of just come up from my body? How does all that work? That's just what we're talking about when we talk about metaphysics. But this one is, this first premise really is just a metaphysical intuition. And what that just means is that our minds are structured in such a way as to understand the world in a particular way. And there are certain principles that we have to hold to in order to make the world intelligible, to make it understandable. One of those things is things like the law of non-contradiction. I can't prove the law of non-contradiction, but I use it in every argument or claim that I make. Right? I can't prove that law, but I understand it because it's a metaphysical intuition that I can't deny without also affirming it. Okay? So there's these basic structures or these basic inclinations of the intellect to understand the world, and this I think is one of those things. Nothing cannot produce something, and I can't tell you anything that is more obvious than that to prove it. Anything that I try to use to argue for the truth of this premise, that whatever begins to exist has a cause of its existence, is less obvious than the premise itself. Okay, so we could go more into that, but I think we'll move on because I think the next one is probably the more controversial one. The second premise is that the universe began to exist, and the justification for these two premises, at least according to a guy named William Lane Craig, is that it's impossible for us to form an actually infinite series of past events. And what he's basically saying is that, look, if we tried to think about an infinite set of events prior to this moment, we run into all sorts of conceptual problems. Mathematicians use infinites all the time, so they're often tempted to think that since we can use infinites sets and that kind of thing in mathematics, therefore, when we talk about an infinite amount of time prior to now, it's meaningful and helpful and instructive. But William and Craig is arguing is that it's not. We can talk conceptually about an infinite, but when we actually try to say there's an infinite number of moments prior to now, we run into a problem. So imagine a person who's infinitely old, and he's been counting for an infinite number of days till he gets up to now, and he walks in the door, 200 billion gazillion gajillion and one, 200 gazillion gajillion whatever and two, 200 gazillion jillion billion and three, right? He says, okay, I guess 200 gazillion jillion billion and four, and it's now. What's the problem? It's not an infinite. It's not infinite. There couldn't have been an infinite number of events prior to now, because if it did, we would be at the end of an endless series of events. What Craig and others point out that is that, look, what this shows is that the idea of applying an infinite number, or thinking about the series of events prior to now as being infinite, is a conceptual problem. You can think of it that way, but you can't actually form an actually infinite number of moments or events. It's impossible by the nature of the case, by the definition of what an infinite is. It's an unending series of events. How can you be at the end of an endless series of events? He gives other arguments to show that it's impossible to have an infinite series of events as well. He shows that there's some conceptual problems in saying, look, if I had an infinite number of red books and an infinite number of black books, and I put them together, it'd still be an infinite number of books. If I took an infinite number of books and subtracted an infinite number of books, I could result in both zero or an infinite number of books. So what he's saying is that, look, even if it's useful for certain applications in mathematics, it doesn't apply to reality. It's kind of an abstract argument, and this is why I'm saying if we really wanted to understand this argument, you need a series of, like, talks just on the Kalam cosmological argument or just on the arguments for the existence of God. Because, again, there's objections to these, and we would need to talk about those. But so the first justification that Craig gives for this premise that the universe began to exist is that there couldn't have been an infinite series of events prior to now. There had to be a beginning point. He follows this up by giving scientific confirmation and saying that, look, Big Bang cosmology is pretty much the accepted scientific view right now, and it says that there was a beginning to the universe. Okay? So we know this there's debates, there's people who object to this by saying that the universe is this sort of oscillating theory where it explodes up and then it shrinks down again and blows up again and shrinks down again and that kind of stuff. But those theories are actually not very widely accepted. The Big Bang theory actually started out with Edwin Hubble when he realized that there was redshift when he looked at the furthest objects in space. If you think about a train in Waxhaw, it's coming closer to you. You know, the sound kind of sounds different when it's coming closer to you and then when it gets to you and then when it's going away. It's because the wavelength of the sound waves actually shrink as they're coming closer to you. And they get more elongated as they get further from you. Well, something like that happens with light. And what Hubble found is that everything at the furthest reaches of the universe that we know of is going away from, like a big explosion. And in about 1948, I think, people were theorizing about what, if there was a Big Bang, what would that look like in terms of background radiation and that kind of stuff. And later on, in about 1964, they actually discovered the background radiation that they had theorized based on this Big Bang model. So there's a whole lot more to talk about in terms of those evidences, but I just wanted to kind of give you a really brief overview of what kind of argument, or what the reasons for that premise is. So we start with whatever begins to exist has a cause of existence. We talked a little bit about why we think that premise is true. We talked about the universe began to exist. And there's a reason because of the nature of there not being able to be an infinite series of events prior to now. We talked just briefly about modern cosmology seems to substantiate this. And therefore, if these premises are true, then the conclusion the universe has a cause of its existence seems to follow, logically. But does that yield God? The next question an atheist could ask is, okay, fine, there's a cause of existence, but lots of philosophers have said that there's first causes of things that don't themselves have causes. But is it God? And Craig says, look, it can't be. The cause of the universe, by the nature of what we observe now, it can't be just a set of necessary and sufficient conditions. Because if it were, the universe would have always existed. Right? But there was a time, prior to its existence, there was nothing. And then there was something. This suggests that there was some kind of volition involved. That it's a will. That God is personal. Not just a set of necessary and sufficient, like, natural laws. And in fact, you'd say, look, the natural laws themselves, the strong and weak nuclear force, the electromagnetism, gravitational forces, all those things require some kind of explanation for why they are the way they are as well. They're all finely tuned in some way to each other and as a whole, and they could have been different. know? So he says, look, it's more reasonable to think that a personal God created it than not a personal God, than just to set a force. Is everybody doing okay so far? Okay. and I'll just, we don't have much time. I'll follow up with one more real quick one. I'll tell you two, and then I just won't go into much depth about them, but I'll just tell you. The design argument often goes something like this. Again, there's many forms of all of these arguments, but here's one. The fine-tuning of the universe is either due to physical necessity, chance, or design. It is not due to physical necessity or chance. Therefore, it is due to design. That's just one example of the argument. Again, we can't go into that. I'm running short on time. I'm sorry. Moral argument is, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, God exists. Again, these arguments follow of necessity. If the premises are true, the conclusion is true. What we probably need to do, for those of you who are interested in diving into these things, is to go into detail about how you defend each one of these premises. You know, we just began to touch on what's called the Kalam cosmological argument, but each one of these arguments, the design argument, the moral argument, we need to actually go in and give a robust defense of each premise. I just want to finish by saying that I think while these arguments are fruitful for us engaging atheists and agnostics, and it's helpful, and I've seen this work much more effectively when I dialogue with atheists and agnostics. When I try to give them a personal testimony or experience or something like that, they don't take me seriously at all. But when I actually start engaging them and saying, here's some arguments, they actually start participating in the conversation. So I think there's this evangelistic point to learning these arguments. But it's more than that. I think a lot of us don't understand that our understanding of God has been handed down to us from our Protestant tradition. And our Protestant tradition picked up a lot of our view of God from the medieval theologians and Catholic and Eastern Orthodox thinkers. And they used these arguments to develop their theology. So the first cause argument, for example, that Thomas Aquinas gives is the basis for a lot of his theology, his view of who God is. So if we're ignorant of it, we're ignorant of the reasons for some of the things that we might believe about God, that he's timeless and spaceless, that he's all-powerful. There are things that we can gather from Scripture about that, but there's also things that are a little more difficult to justify from Scripture that have actually come from these arguments, and if we don't understand how they're arrived at, we actually are ignorant about the things that we believe about God, where they came from. Finally, I think that these arguments help us in the bigger picture of our Christian sanctification, because I believe that part of our Christian sanctification is growing in our ability to think through things carefully, especially matters of faith, to think through arguments for God's existence, to think about the resurrection and the historical evidences for that, but then to the implications of those things in how we view God, right? So I think it's valuable for our Christian sanctification, and I think it's valuable for engaging the culture in a meaningful way. And again, I hope that what we have to say here in about apologetics this summer isn't the end of what you guys do in apologetics. I hope some people are at least really interested and want to dive further and deeper into these things. But I'll go ahead and pray. Okay.